Blog Talk Radio.
Of Allah, the beneficent, the merciful. I bear witness that there is no God but Allah. I bear witness that Muhammad is his messenger. I bear witness that the Honorable Mr. Louis Farrakhan is our divine reminder. And I greet you all, the distinguished panel, as well as the listening audience, and I greet in words of peace. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
Wa alaikum salam.
Ooh, that almost
Wa
didn't come out
salam.
Right.
All right, let's do this.
Okay. All right. I'm fighting this cold, but I'm going to carry on anyway. I don't care if I do sound like a vacuum and a locomotive. I'm carrying on. Okay. Welcome back to part two of Motown. We are paying homage to Motown kind of sort of, you know, I'm sad that Motown is out of business, but whatever. But the music is everlasting.
That's
and
right.
Tonight we're going to honor some of the best groups to make the best music in the best era of time for black music. You know, that was when we sung about real love, not
That's
sex.
Right.
When we sung about black pride and not killing each other, you know. And when love was really, really, truly love. You know, love was so tough back then. We ain't need no money. You know, we were so in love. we would sleep under a bridge with the ones we love. That's the kind of love we need today.
Right.
Because, you know, we own some more stuff today. But anyway, allow me to introduce my distinguished panel, the mighty, mighty FOI, and all the way from, let me see, who should I start with? Eeny, meeny, mighty, moe. All the way from Chicago, Illinois, Brother Daniel Muhammad. I should say Brother Daniel Motown Historian Muhammad. Come down front and center, soldier. Introduce yourself.
Assalamu alaikum, family. My name is Daniel Muhammad from Miles Marion. Been in the nation of Islam for 23 years.
All praise is due to Allah.
And Motown sound is my first love.
Okay. All
out
right.
of my musical taste.
Oh, I thought Susie May was your first love, but okay.
No, I'm saying this music is my first, out of my musical taste, is my first love.
Absolutely. Thank you for that, Brother Daniel. And all the way from St. Louis, Missouri, Brother Kareem Muhammad, front and center soldier.
Well, assalamu alaikum, and in the name of Allah, the beneficent, the merciful, who came to us in the person of Master Farad Muhammad. Again, I want to thank you for allowing me to come and sharing this wonderful historical experience. That's right, I'm here in St. Louis, Missouri, Muhammad Miles number 28. And all I can say is let's get rolling.
Yes, sir.
Because I want to hear you sing.
You want to hear me sing?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. If you ever heard a train sing, you're going to hear it tonight.
Lord, ever.
My beloved dear brother, who I always say is from all over the nation, he hails from Cincinnati, Ohio. He's currently in Washington, D.C., but this brother is from all over the nation. Front and center, student minister Jamil Muhammad.
Assalamu alaikum, family. I'm glad to be here tonight. To all of my fellow panelists and to our gracious and glorious host, Sister Gidget Muhammad, to all of the listeners, I'm really excited tonight. I'm speaking to you actually from inside Muhammad Mosque number 4 tonight, where we're completing the first of what we hope to be an annual event. It is a Savior Day gift webathon. And so tonight, everybody's jamming all over the Mid-Atlantic region, the Eastern region. We even got a donation from the Southwest region tonight as people are giving to the Savior's Day gift and promoting and pushing this program. So we're very, very excited to be here and excited to talk about the mighty Motown history that formed the music that made the soundtrack of our lives and brought us up into this understanding. So Sister Gidget, pull the ripcord on this bad boy. Let it go. Let it rip.
You know, I was looking at the music that I remembered, and there's some of the music, of course, I didn't remember, but I looked at some of the groups, and then, you know, some of them had some songs that a lot of us, you know, that were very popular, and, you know, they were hit records or whatever, and then some of them were like, I think like what they call one-hit wonders. But
right.
The thing about all of the music that I listened to is that it was so clean, you know, it was so clean, it was so uncomplicated, it was loving, it was prideful, it was respectful, and the sound, you could hear the instruments, you know, not no DAT machines, not no computers, you can hear the instruments and the magic of the Funk Brothers putting it down the way music is supposed to be put down. And so the first group I want to talk about tonight is a group that we didn't hear from too much back then, and we certainly don't hear from them now. However, they made one song that has rang from generation to generation to generation, and that group I'm talking about is called The Originals. And I'm going to go to Brother Daniel. What can you tell me about that fine group of brothers right there?
Well, The Originals, they were a backup group prior to releasing Baby I'm For Real in 1969. They basically, when they released Baby I'm For Real, that was produced by Marvin Gaye and his wife at the time, Anna Gaye.
Uh-huh.
And
Okay. And who was in the group? Do you remember? Do you know their names?
No, I don't recall the names. And also I recall them as a doo-wop group called the Voice Masters.
Oh, so those were the Voice Masters?
Yes.
Wow, who knew? Brother Jamil.
Yes, ma'am, I'm here.
What you know about their originals?
Well, is what Brother Daniel just talked about. I know that they were the concept in terms of their incarnation on Soul Records under the Motown banner. They were the concept of Marvin Gaye, who many people, we talked about this last week, Marvin Gaye is a drummer, or was a drummer. And Marvin Gaye having that impeccable sense of rhythm along with his own gift for singing. And by the way, Teddy Pendergrass was a drummer too before
right.
he came out. But Marvin Gaye actually produces the group, and you hear that on the sound of Baby I'm For Real and the sound of the bells. You can almost hear that same kind of, that you hear that Marvin Gaye kind of a sound. And then, you know, they drop right into a baby, baby, you don't have to go home. Right? That's
you
real
know
mellow. That's that real mellow thing.
I don't want
thing.
You to sing too much tonight to where you get to the freestyle and then act like you all know what to say.
Yeah,
okay?
Right. But I want to tell you now, this is a very special record for me, Daniel, because I may be a little older than all the rest of y'all, but that was my first slow drag on Baby I'm For Real.
Right.
Yes, indeed. Boy.
And it's a song that they released in 66. As a matter of fact, I got it at home, got it in my possession, called Suspicion. And a song that they did was never released, and another song that was never released called When Was the Love Was Gone. It was also sang by the Isley Brothers later on, back around 66 or 67.
Yeah, see, that's the man who knows right there. That man knows what he's talking about.
Okay, and Brother Kareem, what you know about the originals?
What do I know about the originals? Just that one song. Because, see, you got to understand something. I came up in a house myself. See, I've been in the nation all my life. I came up in a house with an MGT. And at that time, we didn't listen to no radio. I didn't get a chance to check out a lot of music until I was 11, 12, 13 years old and had gone to stay with my dad. So, a lot of this is this history. That's why I'm listening and hanging on every word, because a lot of this history I didn't know. I just know that when I got a chance to begin to enjoy the music, how it soothed my soul, how it attracted me.
Well, I know what you mean, because I grew up in the nation, and we had two records in our house.
Exactly.
I remember the album of Mahalia Jackson. I remember the song In the Upper Room. And I remember some stuff by Scott Joplin. And that was all the music
Hello.
We had. But
right.
when my father made his transition and I was exposed to another world, I really caught up on some old school music, as they say. So we're going to go ahead and listen to the originals, and I'm going to tell y'all something about this song. I tell you what, and just tell me if I'm the only one, this really, really takes you all the way back to your first love. Listen to this.
Baby, baby, you don't understand how much I love you, baby, and how much I wanna be your only man. Oh, baby, 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 you don't have to go. Stay a little while longer, baby. I wanna talk to you just a little more. I see the little tears in your eyes about to fall. You are wondering if I'm for real. But if you cry, I wonder why you cry. I tell you, no, this is how I feel. Baby, I'm for about it. Girl, I just couldn't live without you, and that's why I'm confessing my love to you.
You otherwise, if he could sing like that.
I tell you, family.
Yes, sir.
I'll tell you a song that really that they put out. I don't think I know Brother Jamil is familiar with it. God bless whoever sent you.
No, I'm not.
It came out around 71, about 70 or 71.
Yeah, I remember that song. But
right.
I think this was the most popular one.
Exactly.
That, they made.
That was their first number one hit.
Mm-hmm. I don't think they ever had another hit as high as Baby I'm For Real, did they?
No, not really, sir.
Yeah, I didn't think so.
I think they did either. I mean, I kind of kept up with Motown. But, you know, I want to talk about this because, you know, I think back then, you know, when I finally got a chance to look at television a little bit at about 13 or 14 years of age, you know, they were the superstars. You know, because they were on television, they were always cleaner than the Board of Health. You know, they all had on these suits. They was dressed to the nines. You know, their hair was laid. You know,
right.
And they moved with precision. They had jewelry, and they was just pretty, you know, whatever. But, you know, some of them, most of them, struggled financially, whether it was due to you know, whether, you know, bad contract negotiations or whatever it was. And I think a lot of us grew up thinking that, hey, these were superstars and they were rich and, you know, and they were actually struggling. And so I want to speak to the era. Brother Jamil.
Well, one of the things, and I'm just a key point.
In the record business, huh?
Well, let me, I'm thinking that your question is very, very good. And the reason why, and we've seen in Robert Townsend's movie, The Five
Heartbeats.
Oh, yeah.
The fictional character, the quote, I'm throwing up air quotes now, the fictional character of Red, who hung the man off the balcony.
And that really happened to Jackie Wilson.
Well, yeah, hold on. Hold on. Now. I was going to tell it, Danny, but you. According to legend.
We'll get your version. Okay, what you say, Brother
According to legend, Jackie Wilson signed with a fellow who was somewhat unscrupulous. His name was Nat Turner Paul, and who put in with Brunswick Records out of Chicago, where Jackie Wilson stayed, and his career was managed in that way. Jackie Wilson never became a spectacularly wealthy man. Barry Gordy structured his company where Barry Gordy made the lion's share of the profit, not the artist. That was the order of the day in the business at that time. There was a record company in Houston, Texas called Peacock Records, which had, right. Was a gospel label, and another label that they had, the twin label for R&B and blues, called Duke Records, out of Houston, Texas. Is owned by one Mr. Don Roby. Don Roby was known to be a fellow who did not take no for an answer and really fixed it so that he got the answer that he wanted from the act that he wanted to promote. That was the order of the day in the record business. And so the record business was a business where you did not have a lot of artists with either creative control or significant advantages in terms of money. Minister Farrakhan has taught about this, and I know that you all know this. The minister said that the enemy, he wants to be wealthy. The black man wants to be known. And that arrangement, we became famous, but we lost wealth. And we never had or accumulated wealth. And even those of us who were able to accumulate trinkets, they would gerrymander and trick the system and rig the system to take all of our money. Ask, well, you can't ask them anymore. They've gone on to their transition. But you could ask Sammy Davis Jr. and Red Fox about that. They became wealthy in terms of trinkets, but they lost what they had because of unscrupulous management, a record company and entertainment business that was set up against the artist, and their overarching desire was to succeed at their craft, become known as the best who ever did it, and many of them did, but sadly they did not make a lot of money. That's true.
And, you know, and when you think about the fact that they had families and how often that they toured and they stayed on the road and they were broke. Some of them were literally broke. Some of them were living in hovels. Some of them lived in rooms. Some of them still live with their mom and them. I mean, you know, it was, but they made, you know, and I'm saying, like, I don't even know if now, you know, I don't know if any justice has been done, but some of these groups, like the family of, and I'm just pulling it out of the air, let's say the family of David Ruffin, the family of Eddie Kendricks, you know, the music is still used. Are they getting royalties for when people sample their music or when they're used in commercials? You know, are they paid royalties for that, or does that money go to Motown / MCA / whoever owns the rights to the music? I mean, you know, because the Temptations and the Jacksons should have money coming out of the ear as much as their music is sampled.
I don't want to monopolize this discussion, but let me just briefly interject to say this. I spoke the other day with Paul Williams Jr. His father is Paul Williams of the Temptations, the late Paul Williams of the Temptations. Paul Williams Jr. sings with an aggregation or a group, a lineup of brothers who sing the Temptation songs in various different venues around the country. He's still toughing it out. And to answer your question, no, they do not get paid well, because those who own the rights to the songs and who own the names to the group and who own the legal considerations connected with those groups are the people who get paid. The system was rigged. And the minister was right. I know we're not on this show to preach tonight and talk about you know, too much preachy stuff, but it's true. The Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan did inform us that the way that this enemy has set up the situation is to rob us blind. We become known, they become rich, and we don't become in any way able to recover from what they put on us. So it's a terrible thing, but that's the way they do it.
Yeah, but we do want to teach, Brother Jamil, because we have so many people who may go back in time and look at those videos and listen to this music and think and that, you know, this is, you know, just success in itself. This is heaven on earth. And they don't know the inner workings of a music, especially my group of youngsters from young, gifted, and black, you know, they're into this independent artistry thing, but their dreams are, of course, to sign on to these record labels. And, of course, we're trying to encourage them to remain independent because they don't even have an idea of how these music companies work. And now that they're doing these 360 deals, you know, you got to make so much money before you get a return. And they're the only one that's keeping the book. So they're the only ones that really get the real numbers of how many records sold. And then you got to pay for promotions. You got to pay your attorney. You got to pay your accountant. You got to pay your, you know, your consultant, your designer, whatever. You know, they have all these other financial obligations that they know nothing about. And so, you know, they need to know that those practices back then are still in existence today.
That's
so,
right.
Yes, sir, even we like to have fun, but we like to teach first and foremost.
That's
okay.
Right.
Anything else about the originals, Brother Daniel, or either the music business itself? You know, what do
you,
say
about... I'm going to say this. I was blessed back in 91. I was at the Bud Billick Parade. Me and a few brothers were selling the final cars, blessed to see the Dales. And Chuck Barksdale of the Dales, you know, I talked to him on the side, and I said, hey, you know, when you all was the consultants for Five Heartbeats, and they told me, just what, you know, what Brother Jamil was saying, what happened in the movie when the guy named Big Red was holding Bird over the balcony, and he told me, you know, the same thing, you know, what when I say it was Jackie Wilson, they the ones told me that actually happened to Jackie Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
See, and also, you know, to add to that, Leonard Chess of Chess Records in Chicago,
mm-hmm,
on Michigan Avenue was the shadiest owner.
Yeah. Well, he
and
had neck
the music industry. And here's the thing, people don't know. Billy Stewart came to his office with a double barrel shotgun and demanded his royalties.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And Leonard Chess had no choice but to give him his money.
And see, and Billy Stewart, if y'all don't know Billy Stewart now, listeners, and I'm waiting for the callers to call him, but Billy Stewart is that really distinct vocalist. He's out of Washington, D.C., made the version of Summertime. And
right.
So
sang in the choir with Marvin Gaye.
Yeah, right here in Washington, D.C. And also, I got to tell you, Brother Dan, you spot on with the Leonard Chess information because he was a shady character. Another fellow from the same group of people that he came from was another fellow named Sid Nathan.
Right.
Sid Nathan owned a label called King Records and had a another label subsidiary called Federal and then a country label called Star Day. And
right.
All those record labels were based there in Cincinnati, Ohio. King Records had the biggest record-selling black artist of its time, individual artist. His name was James Brown. James Brown had become as hard, tough as he was because he was dealing with that crooked Sid Nathan, and he had to do like Billy Stewart and demand his royalties. So you're right, Sister Gidget. This was a time when people were being exploited left and right.
And let me add to this, though, family. VJ Records here in Chicago, when they went bankrupt in 65 or 66, the fellow who was part of VJ Records was supposed to keep everything in line was a fellow by the name of Ewart Abner, who later became the president of Motown.
Yeah.
And he had a little bad reputation of being a terrible gambler.
Mm. Wow. So, what Muddy Waters and Etta James and Chuck Berry under his label? I mean,
no, ma'am, not with VJ, with Chess Records.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying,
VJ,
with Chess Records.
VJ had Jerry Butler, the
mm-hmm.
Dales,
mm-hmm.
Meddy Collier, and Jane Chandler once upon a time.
You know who VJ also had? VJ was a black-owned label out of Chicago.
Yes,
but
right.
You know who they also had?
at that certain time, VJ had Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons.
Sure did.
And they also had the Beatles before the Beatles went to Capitol.
Went big.
That's right. The Beatles came over, and their first single, I saw her standing there, the one that was breaking before they left England, you know. She was just 17, you know what I mean, and the way she looked was way beyond compare. How could I dance with another when I saw her standing there? Those are records that DJ
right.
brought out.
Was owned by Vivian Carter, the Carters.
Mm-hmm. So they actually did that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think it's unfortunate, and I think that in this generation of musical stars now, we could come up a little bit and look at all of the contracts and how they're negotiated now with, I'm gonna say, some more esteem artists like Beyonce, Alicia Keys, Chris Brown, Anthony Hamilton. But these people had to really get their attorneys involved and have to really go over their contracts with a fine-tooth comb and really hammer that out. But I think in desperation back in those days, just to get your song on the air and just to be an artist, you know, you kind of just signed and agreed to anything. And, you know, that's unfortunate. But,
right.
We're gonna move on, and we're going to talk about another group from Motown, which I know Brother Jamil and Brother Daniel particularly can talk about these group of fellas. And I'm going to play a song that they made that I personally love. I know they have a lot of popular songs that maybe you all remember, but I had to pick one. And I just think this is their most profound one when it goes to comes to expressing love. But tell us about the Miracles, because we know Smokey Robinson, but and Ron, I think his name Ron White.
Ron White.
And
Bob Rogers and Pete Moore.
Okay, so Ron White died about 20 years ago, and Bob, what's his name?
Bob Rogers died about 4 weeks ago.
Okay, and who was the other guy?
Pete Moore, the bass singer.
Who was it?
Okay,
Pete
I never
Moore.
Heard any bass in the Miracles, but okay.
Right, but he was a little short, stocky fellow.
Yeah, Pete Moore, he's the bass singer. Then Ronnie was a baritone singer.
Right.
Bobby Rogers, he also sang
was
tenor
a tenor.
In the background. Right. And so Emerson Rogers, his brother
cousin.
Was a tenor. Yeah, cousin was a tenor. And then you had
Claudette,
right, who married Smokey. Right.
Right.
Okay, I got you.
Okay.
Right.
So now they were kind of like, if I'm not mistaken, they were kind of like the first hit-making group, one of the first hit-making groups for Motown.
Right,
and
like
course,
the second one.
Barry ones. And Smokey were very, very close in their personal relationship as well as their
right.
professional relationship, right?
That's correct. That's absolutely correct.
Uh-huh. Some people say that they are the ones who actually started the Motown sound, defined it. You know, in 1954, you got to understand, they've been around a long time. 1954
right.
is 59 years ago. When the Miracles were formed, when they were in high school in Detroit.
Right.
Their original name was the Matadors.
Matadors.
The Matadors was their name. And that's what they did. And boy, you're talking about setting it off. That's what they did.
Right.
And
well,
they started at Motown.
Let me ask y'all something about this. Okay, because you know what was so confusing to me? Now, a lot of times, a lot of singers would go from group to group, but then a lot of the group names would change. And what was the purpose for that? I mean, you know, because I know in the Temptations movie, they alluded to the fact that the Temptations kind of picked their name out of a book or something.
Out of a hat. They really picked their name. I'm going to say this, Sister Gidget. They picked their name out of a hat.
Oh, okay.
That's what basically would happen.
You saying why did their name change?
The names change frequently at Motown. You know, like the primes and the primates became.
Yeah, the Temptations and the Supremes. But often, see, these are responses to trying to get a start in the business. Some people say the Matadors changed their name to the Miracles because at a certain time they were trying to hope for a miracle to boost their career.
Right.
Then sometimes there were the record company executives that wanted a jazzier name, wanted something more
right.
lofty, more aspirational. And so they gave these names because these were the best names they could get. And it's the process of creativity in motion. I think that's what you're seeing in that history.
Okay. And then a lot of them switched around, too, to different groups. What was that about?
Well, I would say this. You know, from what I've seen and heard, where you have, you can have petty differences in the group or egos. And, you know, and also when a certain member haven't made their mark in a certain record and they never got their just due, when they go to another group, when they make their mark with a hit record, they got their just due and their respect. You know, just like, for example, Dennis Edwards, he was with the Contours till the group disbanded in 1967 when David Ruffin got, you know, put out the group. He made his mark with the Temptations after, you know, when they released Cloud Nine.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Well, whatever happened, I'm going to play this song by the Miracles, and I think this is one of the, I'm not going to say the sweetest, but I think that when a man loves you so much, even though it might be some stuff he can't stand about you,
right?
This is a good song. So here we go, the Miracles.
I don't like you, but I love you. Seems that I'm always thinking of you. So you treat me badly. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
Yeah, now see, I'm going to tell you something. I got to jump in here now. See, because I can relate to that song. I can straight relate to that song. I ain't giving you no history on it, but I can straight relate to that song.
But I'm going to be honest, I played that song because it reminds me of my ex-husband.
Okay.
He used to tell me that. He used to say, oh, I can't stand you, but I can't go either. So I was like, oh, baby. Oh, honey. I got a hold on you, boy. What's up with that? Okay. But y'all have to excuse me. I have a real bad call, but we're going to take a call from area code 215. Make your mic live right now. And assalamu alaikum. Who's on the line?
Wa alaikum assalam. What's going on?
Oh, ain't nothing going on. We just jamming. How are you? And who's calling?
This is Brother James. He's calling from Philadelphia.
Assalamu alaikum, Brother James.
Well,
thank you so much,
Brother
James.
Yeah, y'all taking it back to the old school today. I probably was made off that song.
Okay, you was born in 62, soldier.
No, I was born in 1980.
Okay, 18 years before. 18 years after.
Yeah, my question was pertaining, you were talking about the temptations, and, you know, I can't really, you know, I didn't experience them when, you know, when he was out, but I looked at the movie, and I just wanted to know if that was true or not when he was, he had the cover, and they didn't really want to acknowledge, you know, African-American artists, so they kind of manipulated the cover with other things, you know, put other
yes.
people on there, so that was
absolutely,
that was absolutely true.
I know they had a scene like that in the Five Heartbeats.
Right. You know, Sister Gidget, let me say this to the brother out there. See, white folks got offended when they see black people on the album cover. They'll use a cartoon. For example, like the Temptations' first album called Meet the Temptations. Daddy used a silhouette background to lighten their faces so the white people who would buy those records, they wouldn't get offended seeing in her dark face
mm-hmm.
on the album cover. Even when you know, when doo-wop was coming out, they, you know, white folks didn't want to hear no black voice singing doo-wop. They'd rather hear a white voice singing doo-wop.
You have to understand that the time, the middle 20th century, was a country where in many of the states in what they call the Sun Belt today, segregation was entirely legal, enforced upon poor and unfortunate and illiterate and undereducated and underfed and poorly housed black people. You have to understand that in the middle part of the 20th century, in the 50s and 60s, my brother, when these songs were released, black people were struggling for basic civil rights and had not even thought about human rights. They were looking for the right to vote, and they were looking for the Public Accommodations Act, none of which were in force when these songs that we're playing tonight were released. There had been no March on Washington by Dr. King, let alone a Million Man March. There had been no Black Power movement, no riots, no civil disturbances, no uprising in Watts or Detroit or Newark or Cincinnati or Washington or Plainfield, nowhere. So black people were coming up out of the bottom, and whites were very clear. They did not want to see you or give you credit for doing anything creative. I watched a movie the other night, Sister Gidget, called Cairo, 1942. It was released starring Jeanette MacDonald and Robert Young, and it also had an appearance by, and really she stole the movie, by Ethel Waters. Ethel Waters was underbilled under all of them, even though it was her movie. Dooley Wilson, the actor who played Sam in Casablanca. You played it for her, I'm playing for me. You must remember.
Right.
You remember him?
Yes,
Wilson,
sir.
Again, Sam.
But their billing comes way at the bottom, way below everyone else. And in many other movies, blacks weren't credited at all. So, yes, brother, it's true. Album covers would have an inanimate object, a picture of some grass and trees, a picture of anything else, but not a Negro, if it could at all be avoided. So that's very true.
That's right.
Yeah, I had another question. you know, obviously, you know, even listening to the music back then, you know, even the music that she was playing, I could see that it was a different quality of music from today. You know, it was more of a, it was a better quality of music back then. It seems like, you know, even from the bands playing in the background, even to the lyrics of the songs, it seems to have been better quality back then. But what I heard, I don't know if it's true or not, was if somebody could break it down for me. Now, when all these bands were coming out for the Temptations, the 500, the Solid, you know, they got a category that they call it soul music. And I think I overheard somebody saying that, you know, after all these African-American bands came out, they needed a white band, so they created the Beatles. It was some type of thing that they were saying about that. If anybody, you know, I overheard somebody saying that, you know, that they created the Beatles to kind of, I guess, you know, be a white version of those groups or something to that extent.
Well, I'm the oldest. Let me say this. Can y'all hear me?
Yes, sir.
I don't believe the Beatles were created by some nefarious plot in a laboratory by some wicked scientist on top of a castle on a thundering lightning night.
Right.
That's right.
I believe these were white boys in Birmingham, England, who had never heard anything like what they heard being done by black artists in the United States, and they imitated.
That's right.
Right.
When they imitated it, they were able to take advantage of their fresh face, good looks, their mop top haircuts, and their tapered pants suits, and they made us. They became like Justin Bieber or, you know, Backstreet Boys or whatever. They were just
oh.
And they imitated black. That's what they did. Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir. And if I may interject. This is Brother Kareem. If you go back and you check into the history of all of that, and I agree with you, Brother Jamil.
Right.
They never heard anything like it. If you go back and check into the history, if you go back and look at some of the documentaries on the Beatles, groups like the Beatles, Average White Band, Little Wiggles Band, all these different bands, they will tell you that that's how they got their sound. When black music, because black music here in America, like you said, they didn't want to see our face. They didn't want us to be on nothing. They wanted to enjoy it, but they didn't want to admit that, I'm going to just say it, that this came from the God. So what they did was they would hide us. But when the music went to other countries, Australia, to Europe, places like that, it was free over there. And when they heard it, like Brother Jamil said, they never heard nothing like that, and they tapped into it. And that's how they got their sound. That's how they built their foundation based on our music. So they took what we couldn't get credit for and were able to build whole genres based on it.
Yeah, that's very interesting stuff. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, and I want to add to that, too. The Rolling Stones, they admitted also
mm-hmm.
that black music influenced them. Just like, for example, a fella by the name of Muddy Waters, who influenced
them. Come on
now.
Awesome.
And also Buddy Guy. And these
mm-hmm.
blues singers influenced the Rolling Stones. Because, you know, majority of those groups try to sound like black artists. You know, if you listen to their sound, even though they came from England, they try to emulate the black artists on vinyl at that time.
Yes, sir. Okay, listen, y'all. Thank you, Brother James, for your questions, and thank you for calling in, sir. Thank you for supporting us again. I remember you calling in on our study group, so thank you for joining us tonight.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
And
where are you from, Brother James?
Philadelphia.
I forgot. Philadelphia. Yeah, he calls in on our Friday night study group. Okay, listen, y'all, I'm having some respiratory problems over here. So if y'all don't hear me, y'all roll on, okay?
Yes, ma'am.
And listen, I'm going to tell y'all supposed to cover down for y'all sister. Why y'all tell me mute my phone? I'm over here just coughing.
I didn't know where that noise was coming from.
Okay. Okay. I'm gonna try to finish the show. Okay. Now we gonna go to this group called Martha Reeves and the Vandellas. Now. Now, how can I put this? You know, everybody got their own taste in music. I did not want to not acknowledge them because I know that they are, you know, a part of Motown or whatever. And I was listening to their music, and I was like, wow, you know, even for my taste, as much as I love vintage music, as I call it, or, you know, just good quality music, they, you know, they was all right. You know, in my group, in my opinion, my personal opinion, what do you think about Martha Reeves and the Vandellas? And I know she worked at Motown and eventually
right.
became a singer or was a singer or whatever
that.
Happened, however that happened. What do you think about that group? I'm going to ask Brother Kareem. Brother Kareem, I know you know something about Martha Reeves and the Vandellas.
Yes, I do. And I mean, I enjoy their music. They're not necessarily one of the particular groups that I, you know, was a favorite of mine, but I do enjoy their music. You know, I just think to me, Martha Reeves and the Vandellas music, to me, is what, like, I will make a comparison. For me, it's like what I call bubblegum jazz, okay? I mean, to me, jazz is, just being serious, to me, jazz is like Miles Davis, okay? The Pharaoh, you know, people like that, that's jazz to me. Whereas then you guys, don't get me wrong, I enjoy some of the music, but bubblegum jazz to me is like, what is his name, Kenny G and these other guys that come along, what they're calling smooth jazz now. To me, that's bubblegum jazz. And so Martha Reeves and the Vandellas, to me, it's that kind of music. It's that, you know, it's just fun, you know, that type of thing.
Okay, and Brother Jamil, what you think about Martha Reeves and the Vandellas?
That's a very astute comment that my brother just made, but I think that Martha and the Vandellas were, for me, a group that was never the artistic or commercial equal of groups like the Supremes or even the Marvelettes. However, there was a niche for them. They were they were like the tough girl group. They reminded me of the girls that would be like Pinky Tuscadero on Happy Days.
Yeah. Yes,
right.
The girls that wore the leather jackets, they sang about dancing in the street and the heat wave and Jimmy Mac. You know,
right, exactly, yes.
They weren't lovingly sweet, sensitive songs like the Supreme, you see? So Martha's story was that she was working as an assistant in the A&R department, the secretary.
Right.
A&R department. She was hoping that she would get a shot at a recording contract. And of course, one day they heard her singing in there, and the rest is history.
Right,
you know?
Brother Jamil.
Now, did y'all know that they sang background on Marvin Gaye's song "Stubborn Kind of Fella"?
Right. Yes, sir.
Stubborn kind of fella got my mind made up to love you.
Right, Brother Jamil.
Yeah.
Brother Jamil.
Yes.
Mickey Stevenson has suggested them to sing background.
I know you're going to say something about Mickey Stevenson. I know that.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, we're coming down on the first hour. So let me go ahead and get this song out the way. not one of my favorites, but since I had to pick one by them, this is the one I picked. So sounds like a little stalker move to me, but y'all tell me what y'all think.
Uh-oh.
I knew it.
Yep, bingo.
I'm
it wrong the first time. She running from him. Okay, I thought he needed to run from her. Okay, all right, my bad. Wow. Okay, listen, I'm going to move on because we got a lot of songs to play, and I want to go ahead and get this one out of the way by the Marvelettes. Real quick, Brother Jamil, what's up with them ladies? What's up with them ladies?
Which ones?
The Marvelettes.
The Marvelettes.
Gladys Horton is the second self of God. The Marvelettes.
What?
In my
house,
Gladys Horton.
I can't hear you, Brother Jamil. Talk up.
Uh-oh.
I said Gladys Horton and her little crew from Kingston, Michigan. They are like the second self of God. Smooth, pretty voices. They sang mm-hmm. things that had a lot of meaning, and they changed lineups a lot, but they still were able to make hits. So they went through a lot of changes from, if you consider, like, 1962, they come out with, you know, Please, Mr. Postman, okay? The Beatles later cover it and make a big hit out of it. But between then, listen to the growth of their sound, where at the end of their career, they're singing, at the end of their time together, they're singing my favorite, which is Don't Mess With Bill. Then they come into Smokey Robinson's song, Anytime the Hunter Gets Captured by the Game.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're looking at groups that actually are able to communicate very subtle and mature romantic themes.
Right.
Change in affection. Who's the aggressor? Who's the one that turns around on other people? Very, very good soul group, and they were beautiful, beautiful singers. Beautiful singers. High school girls from Inkster, Michigan, a little black town. They ate the house, the blacks who worked for Ford Motor Company in the western part of Wayne County. So that's what happened. And that's what happened.
Okay, and Brother Daniel, what's up with the Marvelettes as far as you're concerned? Since Brother Jamil thinks one of them is the church of God.
I'm going to have to block that part when he said the second part, self of God. That's a little joke, Brother Jamil.
That's all.
Okay. The Marvelettes consist of Gladys Horton, Katherine Anderson, Juanita Colwert, Georgiana Dobbins, Wanda Young. And at the time, when unfortunate things happened to certain members of the group, they had to leave for health reasons and whatnot when it reduced to a trio. When Gladys Horton gave birth to her son,
mm-hmm.
he had cerebral palsy, but she had no choice but to leave the group because she had to take care of that child. Gladys Horton was later replaced by Annie Bogan, who stayed with the Marvelettes to the end when they disbanded in 1971. They was together in Motown for 10 years, 1961 to 1971. And one of my favorite Marvelettes, few of my favorite Marvelettes songs were The Hunter Gets Captured by the Game, Destination Anywhere, My Baby Must Be a Magician, and Here I Am Baby, who was sang before my Marvelettes made it a hit, was the late Barbara McNair, who sang, recorded in 1965.
Okay. All right. Brother Kareem, what you know about the Marvelettes?
Just that one song. I mean, I've heard the rest of them, but that one song, which is my favorite by the Marvelettes, My Baby Must Be a Magician. You know, and I love that. I mean, I love the music. And as I agree with Brother Jamil in the sense that, like he said, I mean, you're looking at growth through their music and how they were able to weave those intricate themes together. And as we were talking about, one of the subjects of our show is the fact that the music during that time, they're a perfect example of that, was not about sex, but was about love. It was about the coming together or even the breaking apart. You know, and I mean, I really enjoyed the Marvelettes music.
Well, the song I selected from them was one that was straight to the point, you know. Sister Girl One Plan, when she say, "Don't mess with her man." So here, don't mess with Bill.
Don't mess with Bill.
Thank you.
Wanda Young, that's what that baby, that little baby fast sweet voice of hers.
And I'm telling you now, if you ever see the video on YouTube, it's an old black and white video. And
right.
And these girls had magic, you understand me? They were not trashy or whorish or nothing. They had on these little dresses, had their little pumps on, had them little teased up bouffant beehive hairdos from the 60s, and they was kicking,
right.
Had that little kick step, that little gentle version of doing the jerk. They was tearing that thing up, okay?
And you know, I'm going to add this to this family. The choreography was taught by the late, great Charlie Atkins.
Yes, yes.
By Pops Charlie Atkins.
That's right.
Who was brought to Motown by the late Harvey Fuqua.
Now, Harvey Fuqua that started the Moonglows.
Moonglows with Marvin Gaye. And David Ruffin was part of it for a minute.
Now, think about this now. Harvey Fuqua is a longtime friend of the Nation of Islam, and every time I would be on the road, particularly in the city where he ended up living, in Las Vegas, Harvey Fuqua, every time we came to town, he found a way to reach out and give a big donation.
Praise be to Allah.
Alhamdulillah.
Always loved, and he would get such a kick out of it because this is up into the 90s, and people didn't really remember the Moonglows anymore. But when he would give a check and it just say Harvey Fuqua and it would say the Moonglows on it, first he was happy because I pronounced his name right. Then I talked about the Moonglows. Oh, really? You remember us? I said, yeah, man, you gave the world Marvin Gaye. And he would smile just as big and bow for the people and they'd give him a big round of applause because they wanted to be known. And when they were known, by the people that they loved and for whom they worked, they were very, very happy. I'm a witness to that.
Let me add to this, family. See, people don't realize with Motown, when they started off, Barry was also not also looking for the hits. He wanted the artists act how they act on stage, but also off the stage, not acting other than themselves.
Well, he didn't do a good job with that one.
But, see, what I'm saying is this. As far as the people who were the staff, like Harvey Fuqua, Charlie Atkins, Thomas Bowles, who's the band coordinator, also in Studio A. Then you had Maxine Powell, who was a great help with the acts. And had them, had the acts, how to act on stage, and how to go into an interview with the proper way and whatnot.
But when you find the...
Oh, okay, so they taught them etiquette.
Exactly. Exactly. That's why, see, family, that's why some of the company, the record companies, were envious of Motown. How do you all did this, yada, yada, yada?
You know, and even though they had animosities among one another, you know, it was never displayed on stage. And I think a lot of times we would
right.
be shocked when we would hear about
right.
the differences between some of the artists because it was never displayed
right.
on stage. When it was stage time, it was stage time, and everybody was on point and everybody did their part. And that is one message that we need to give to our people. When it is time for us to come together, get a job done, put the differences aside, and let's just accomplish what needs
exactly.
to be accomplished.
Allahu Akbar. Right.
My people,
and see one thing. And see, one thing I read, you know, in different biographies of these different artists, they discussed these, what Sister Gidget said, the different members of the groups had differences. Some of them had differences with one another. Or, like what I said in the show before, was my favorite group who held together till unfortunate death took over on some of the members was the Four Tops. And like they
mm-hmm.
said, like they said, for example, we didn't have time to have no petty differences. We love each other like brothers.
Right. And speaking of the Four Tops, I don't know how y'all knew, but that's my next group coming up. Now,
praises be to Allah.
Let me tell you something about these brothers. Now, the one thing that I liked about this particular song, because you know how when you haven't heard a song in a long time, it's like hearing it for the first time over again. Man, some of the bass lines in this music and just the music, just the instrumental music. I mean, I could listen to this song instrumentally all day long. I just love the way it was put together. I love the different drops in the beat. And I just love this song. And so, Brother Jameel, I'm going to come back to you in a minute. But, Brother Kareem, now, I know you're a youngster and everything, but do you know anything about the Four Tops you want to share with us?
Do I know anything about the Four Tops? I mean, all I know is Brother Stubbs, I mean, hey, off the chain. I mean, every song that I know about the Four Tops, I love personally. You know, now, I know my younger brother, may Allah be pleased with him, his favorite song was Sugar Pie Honey Bunch. You know, that was him. You know, and like I say, I mean, I don't know a lot of their history or anything like that. I just know that as far as a group is concerned, I mean, hands down, you know, nobody could touch them.
Okay. All right, Brother Daniel.
Yes, ma'am.
Is there anything you want to add about the Four Tops?
Well, what I'm going to say about the Four Tops, I'm going to let the young brothers hear this. See, when the Four Tops came to Motown, they first sang jazz. And 64, Holland, Doja, and Holland came with Baby, I Need Your Lovin'. And that's what started the ball rolling. As a matter of fact, family, I have in my own collection the Four Tops singing jazz with Motown when Berry Gordy had a little so-called label connected with Motown called Mo Jazz.
Oh, okay.
And remember, Berry Gordy had a record store that was selling jazz music, and that record store, you know, fell as far as when folks were asking Berry Gordy for other music besides jazz.
Okay. And Brother Jamil?
One of the Four Tops are, I mean, their record is pristine. It stands by itself. It needs no comparison or misrepresentation. It calls for what it is. The Four Tops, with the lead voice of Levi Stubbs, who did not need a group. And I think this is also evocative of the ethic of the time. The time was that he was actually a man who could have gone out as an independent or a solo act and done quite well, with a voice as distinctive and, you know, and smooth and yet rough as his.
Right, but and belt out, know how to belt a lyric out, too.
Yeah, and I mean, he, with the passion and with all of the different things that, that made him what he was. But the Four Tops were brothers who, like you said, loved each other, like brothers, stuck together on the basis of professional loyalty, and they sunk or rose together as a group in accord with, for the most part, that's how things were then, in accord with the agreements that the various different brothers made with each other. Excuse me, Four Tops favorite song? I tell you what I'm going to have. My favorite Four Tops song, and it's funny you talked about Sugar Pie Honey Bunch. Now, do you know that another the follow-up hit that they had to that was called It's the Same Old Song?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. It's the same old song with the different meaning since you've been gone. It's the same old song.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, yeah.
Sister Gidget, I got to let you all on this.
Wait. At the beginning of the song, somebody starts the song with, Bernadette. I'm like, who is that? And who does that? Who was that said that part? Bernadette, who was
that's
that?
Levi Stubbs.
That's Levi.
But let me say this to you. Let me finish this, Sister Gidget, because this is really interesting. I didn't know this until just recently studying and looking at Motown, just from the perspective of a fan. It's the same old song is actually the same rhythm of Sugar Pie Honey Bunch, done over, slowed down. They changed a couple of little things, but the core patterns and progressions are the same as Sugar Pie Honey Bunch. And they wanted to make a hit with it, and so the joke with the Funk Brothers and the rest of the folks over at Motown was, this is the same old song. But they had another hit with it because their sound was just that proper. Holland Dozier Holland was producing things they could not miss in those days. They were producing They were producing on the Four Tops. They were producing on
the Supremes.
And I mean, they were just bang, 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 knocking them out the park. And that was another symbol of their success. I'm going to get out the way and let you go on. But they were a great, great power.
Let me let you in, you all in on this. Holland Dozier and Holland, they did an interview one day, and they asked him about Bernadette. And what was funny, they had all three of them, Eddie Holland, Brian Holland, and Lamont Dozier, had the same girlfriends named Bernadette.
Okay, that's too much information. Paul Bernadette. Okay, now, y'all been saying Sugar Pie Honey Bunch, but I believe, if I'm not mistaken, when this record was released, it was called I Can't Help Myself. So here we go with the Four Tops.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm not doing nobody else. In and out.
Number one hit.
Well, that's fine. They can keep all of that. But to me, ain't nothing they put out better than that one. And when you listen to the music, just listen to the instrumental part, man, the way they playing them, those instruments, it's awesome. Awesome. That's all I can say. Awesome. Whatever. It's the epitome of music. Ugh, love it. Love it. All right. All right. We gonna move on. We're going to go ahead and deal with the mighty, mighty Temptations.
Yes.
Now, this is the most tragic group I've ever seen in my life as far as the fact that all of the original members are gone with the exception of Otis Williams. And I'm basing it on the movie, but, I mean, they're gone. That's true. But basing it on the movie, I mean, it was just so sad to me,
right,
that, you know, all of them are gone now, you know. And David Ruffin, oh my goodness, oh my goodness, his voice was, you know, he had that old church blues,
preacher,
down in the ghetto, in the ditch kind of voice, and then he had that voice that just make girls just go crazy, and he had that demeanor. You know, when you in the world, all bad, all girls like bad boys or whatever.
Right.
But the artistry among Paul Williams, Eddie,
right,
Kendricks, and David Ruffin in particularly, they were some awesome, awesome singers. Now, I have never heard Otis sing outside of background. I have never. Now, I'm just saying this personally.
I've heard.
I haven't heard
myself
him sing, and I'm not saying he can't sing. I just haven't heard him sing.
Right.
And I haven't looked for anything that he sings in particularly. But I know in the movie, I think his name is Teron Brooks, who played Eddie Kendricks, said that we are the voices. And I know he was referring to him and David Ruffin. So I'm going to ask you, Brother Jamil and Brother Daniel and Brother Kareem, in your opinion, did the music get better when David Ruffin
You have
and,
reached the maximum time permitted to record. To send your message, press 1 at any time.
Okay. Okay. So, Brother Daniel, what do you think? Is that when their music became the best, when David Ruffin was at it?
Well, yes. You know, everyone, the fan, would tell Otis. I've heard Otis say this in the interview, that the 64-68 lineup was the best lineup that they had. And Otis, he described every last one of the members who had passed on, David Ruffin, Eddie Kendricks, Paul Williams, and Melvin Franklin. And when he described these individuals during that time and what type of personalities they had, see, one thing people don't realize, Melvin, out of that lineup, stuck to the end, to his unfortunate
mm-hmm.
death in February of 1995.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing people don't know, Paul, what he said about Paul Williams, Paul, when he sang a song, whether it was a hit or a standard, he put his effort and his feelings into the song.
Right.
And he said about Eddie Kendricks' voice. He said Eddie Kendricks, he said in a way he was kind of envious of Eddie Kendricks as far as when he sang and the women go crazy and they come want to, you know, get a hold of Eddie like some kind of teddy bear, we'll protect you.
I want to get to this because we're running out of time. The death of Paul Williams and David Ruffin in particularly. Now, I read that for Paul Williams, I know he had sickle cell. I know he had, whether it was a drug or alcohol problem, whatever.
The alcohol problem.
One point, wasn't his death considered suspicious? Didn't they think that he was killed instead of committing suicide?
I'm going to tell you this, Sister Gidget. What I read in the Temptations biography, he actually said on a few occasions he wanted to kill himself. And you know, Otis tried to talk him out of, you know, Paul, don't do that. Don't you sound crazy. And prior to his death, he made a recording with Motown called I Feel Like Giving Up, was never released. You can find it on YouTube also, family. And
uh-huh.
when he died, Charlie Atkins, the choreographer, found his body a few blocks from the Motown Museum with the gun in Paul Williams' hand and they used to travel with this bag back in the 60s, said Tamla Motown, in his vehicle. He shot himself in the head, point blank range. Matter of fact, he died the day Damon Harris, who took Eddie Kendricks' place when he got married, which was August of 73.
Hmm. Okay, Brother Jamil?
I'm back. Yes, ma'am.
So what you think about the death of Paul Williams? Was it suspicious? And the reason why I asked that is because I heard somebody, well, I read where it said that, I don't know if he was left-handed or right-handed, but I know they said that the gun was in the opposite hand in which he would have used to shoot himself. What do you think?
I'm not qualified to make any kind of forensic comments about that, but I can tell you that musically it became the beginning of the unraveling of the Temptations. The funny thing
uh-huh.
was, it was not the unraveling of the Temptations when they lost David Ruffin. Dennis Edwards came in, and there was a great change in the sound and what the group sounded like, but they were still
with the psychedelic soul.
Yeah, exactly. Then when Damon Harris came in, whose first name
was Otis.
Damon. Yeah, Otis, exactly. And when he came in to sing for them, they were
again, still very good. Richard Street, very good. All those guys were good. But when Paul died there in the late summer of 1973, in my view, the soul and what the meaning of being a Temptation was.
He was the backbone of the Temptations.
Mm-hmm. If you look at it, see, I've heard some reports, and Brother Daniel, I don't know if you know about this, Brother Kareem, and Brother James and others, and Sister Gidget, but I've heard reports that Charlie really didn't have to choreograph much of what the Temptations
right.
did
That's
because
right.
Paul
That's
was so talented
true.
As both a choreographer and a dancer. That
right.
Paul was able to handle all of the lead vocals if he wanted to, the mid-baritone leads in his natural, but he could also go up and get those tenor background spots and sing all the harmony parts and go down as low as baritone and be very comfortable. And you had Blue backing him up, Melvin, on the bass. And so the Temps were very, very talented, but oddly enough, perhaps one of the most talented ones in terms of being able to play all the positions on the field, if you will, was Paul Williams. It was a sad day when he died. His son, as I said to you earlier in the program, still carries on in his father's legacy. But as I noticed Paul Jr., in him there's a certain kind of indignant anger. And this is me talking now, but it's in him is kind of an indignant anger because of the refusal of the legal system to recognize and reward his father's work, and even some of the critics and fans who don't understand how essential his father was to the Temptations.
Right.
You know, David
right.
Ruffin came after the Temptations had been formed. David Ruffin right. brought that scintillating, exciting dynamism
was,
in the lead vocals. But there was
right.
in David Ruffin
a
certain way that he handled himself. And then when you look at Eddie Kendricks, Eddie Kendricks is a beautiful, beautiful vocalist, but he was a shy, quiet fellow, ashamed in the early days of their careers because he had what he thought were misformed teeth, and he didn't
right.
want to open his mouth and sing.
Needed dental work.
Needed dental work very bad. Didn't want to, you know, go in front of the public. So there were drawbacks to all of the Temptations in terms of their natural gifts being overshadowed by their insecurity. Paul
right.
at that time did not have that kind of drawback. He was confident, he was capable, and he was extremely talented. And the world today still misses the creative input of Paul Williams. In fact, look at the 1968 television recording of For Once in My Life.
Right. You can find that on YouTube.
The Temptations are wearing, you find it on YouTube as well. Temptations are wearing the gold lamé suits. You don't hear emotional vocals like that anymore. You know?
Right.
I mean, Paul, for once in my life, and I love her, and I love her. I mean, he's doing his thing. It seems histrionic to some, but to Paul, he's just belting it and letting it go. And the Temptations stepped back and let him do his thing. It was a great moment in entertainment history.
And what
Did
about the
this,
death
Sister
of David
Gidget?
Ruffin? Did they ever
Sister
find out what happened to David?
Sister Gidget?
Yes.
You know, what I was going to add about David as far as the personality conflict, brother was talking about his personality. When I saw the documentary Unsung, I said, okay, I see what, you know, led him to be abusive and whatnot. I said, see, those were engrams from what his father, who was a strict, you know, overbearing type of father that he had when he abused him and his brothers and sisters.
Right.
And, you know, Otis described David as being rebellious and edgy, but he also was intense on a lot of things.
So did they ever find out what happened to David Ruffin?
I heard the story that I heard that he's supposed to have over $150,000 in a money bag. He's supposed to have been going to a crack house. You know, I'm hearing these different stories. He went to a crack house. He OD'd. He was a dead on arrival at, he was a John Doe at the hospital in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's a story that I heard as far as the day that he died, and I remember where I was when the day he was down. I just got through Soldier and Final Calls when I heard it on the radio.
Right. Okay. All right. Okay. Well, we're going to move on because we're running out of time. And I know that, you know, My Girl was their biggest hit. But I'm going to play you one of my favorite songs by The Temptations. Well, it's actually my favorite song by The Temptations. Here we go.
Yeah.
Singing together. Brother Jamil.
Yes, ma'am.
Is your phone dropping or are you hanging up?
No, I'm not hanging up, sister. No, it wouldn't hang up on you, and I showed up wouldn't hang up on the Marvelettes. Okay? No.
Listen, we're running out of time, so we're going to move real quick. We're going to move real quick because I got something I need to do at the end. All right. We're going to have to talk about the Supremes. We talked about the Supremes the last time, but as we are honoring groups, we cannot do this without them. So here is a classic by the Supremes, Diane, a.k.a. Diana Ross, and Mary Wilson, and
yes,
I think
love.
Flo is in this song. I think Flo is in this song.
Now, Sister Gidget, before you do the song, you have to remember that Mary Wilson is the second finest woman. Third, she's in the top three with Gladys Knight and Sister LaToya Muhammad from Doggone Baton Rouge. Sister LaToya, the finest one, you know. But after that, come Gladys Knight and Mary Wilson.
You know what?
Let me just make sure the next time
I see you, you got two black eyes. One going to be for Mary and one going to be for Gladys. Because I don't think Sister LaToya can play that. But okay. But here we go with Pat Brown and the Supremes. Here's a classic.
You're in trouble now, brother.
Regrets that he let this young man sing his song. And I guess if y'all don't know by now, y'all will in a minute. The baddest love song ever recorded in Motown history, in my opinion. Here we go. Smokey Robinson, he wrote it for himself, and Michael stole it. He stole it, and I'm so glad that he recorded that song. I don't think Smokey could get down like that. I don't care how much he tried. I know he's a great singer, but I don't think he could have got down like that. What y'all think about little Michael Jackson having that much talent at that age? I think he was 11 when he recorded that.
You know, it's funny, Michael Jackson. Again, I was in elementary school when that song came out, and you know, let me just say,
Okay.
Let me also remind you that Michael Jackson was a student of falsetto singers. He studied Smokey Robinson with his smooth, creamy falsetto. But he also was a big fan of Will Hart. A lot of people don't know that, but Michael Jackson was a big fan of Will Hart. That name may sound familiar to some of you. Will Hart is the founder, along with his brother Wilbur Hart, and Grant Payne and Major Harris of the Delphonics in Philadelphia. So Will Hart had a more bell tone to his high falsetto, but Michael Jackson, I think, was at the perfect intersection of his physical capabilities, his physical, the state of his voice, and whether it was changing or not, or whatever it was doing at that age, and the notes on that page, and his soul, man, that was a great, great, perfect storm for us, the fans, to hear that great music, and we still have it with us. Smokey Robinson was right. I don't think he could have done it in that instance like Michael did.
That's
right. Brother Kareem, what you... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I want to hear Brother Kareem.
Oh, yes. I mean, I agree 100% with your analysis, but, I mean, it's exactly it. For the time, I mean, it was perfect because the way Michael brings that, I mean, you just, man, you make me, you just know. You just know that, like you say, I'm being apologetic. I done messed up. And, I mean, if you, as a matter, I'll just share this with you real quick. As a matter of fact, I used that song back in the day. You know, it's been a long time. But I used it as an apology one time. So, I mean, that's you can't get past it. I mean, let's face it. That, to me, that's the perfect example of a lie in music, period.
Tell me how's that now.
Well, like I said, because of... Like I said, the way that he brings, like I said, the soul that comes through the song. In other words, okay, for example, when I listen to the song, it not only will cause me to be remorseful for something I've done wrong, but it actually evokes the spirit of humility, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, in that particular instance. And that's why I say that. It evokes the spirit of humility in you. In other words, I mean, that brother, Michael's voice throughout the entire range of his career, and like you said, I agree, whether it was changing or not, but at that particular point, I mean, I had never heard somebody, and I was still a youngster too myself, but even as an adult, quote unquote, when you listen to that song, I haven't heard anyone, and not just that song, but in any of the other songs that I've listened to that refer to love and or lost love, or I'm trying to get you back, that has that kind of power. And that's just me personally saying this. You know,
yeah, Michael Jackson has something going, because you clearly are not going to have experience at 11 years old.
Thank you.
Of living the song that you sing about. You know, B.B. King used to say, I like to live the song, the songs that I sing about.
Exactly. At 11, he couldn't have.
He couldn't have. He was 11 years old. So there's something was going on with Michael Jackson beyond him. And I think that was what made him so irresistible to so many people. Minister Farrakhan said Michael Jackson was a god of music. And, I mean,
there has
been a lot to that. You think about his brother, Jermaine, for example. Jermaine was
right.
a great singer and still is.
Right.
And he was the one who was supposed to be the lead singer of the Jacksons. But when the Motown people made the decision, they went with the cute kid thing. You know, Michael Jackson's a cute kid. He's a cute. So they pushed him out there for commercial reasons. But he was more than able to justify that on the basis of his talent. So that's what.
Yes, sir.
Yes,
all right, we gonna slow it down even a little more. We're gonna bring it up in time a little bit, because of course I was trying to do this in chronological order, and I don't know if I got it right. But then, you know, in the 70s, 80s, the music began to change, but Motown still was able to come out and produce some great music, and these brothers all the way from Tuskegee, Alabama, found their way up into Motown some kind of way. And they made one of the best love songs that I ever heard in my life.
Here we go. Here we go.
I'm going to see what y'all got to say. Now, this song is so long, I can't play it all, but I'll play most of it. And
yeah, I know. I knew it. If I could have played everything out of them, man.
Just to be close to you, girl. Just for a moment, well, just for an hour. Just to be close to you, you know, I've been through so many changes in my life, girl. Oh, I've been up real high where I thought I didn't need anybody. Oh, and then again, I've been down real low where there was no one in my life that needed me. Oh, I found that material things I thought had so much value. Oh, girl, didn't really have any value at all. That I was a lonely man, a man with no direction, with no purpose,
chick-a-chick,
with no one to love, and no one to love me for me. Oh, girl, then you came into my life. You made my jagged edges smooth. You made my direction so clear and new. Oh, woman, you became my purpose, my reason for living, girl. You see, you're my heart, you're my soul, you're my stone inspiration, baby. Oh, that's why I'm standing here singing and opening my arms to you. I want to say, child, why don't you... Oh, we'll live in love forever, yeah. Ooh, we'll be alone, you and me, yeah. Girl, we'll live our lives together, yeah, together.
Together, yeah. It's a little bit too long, and I cannot do this show without paying homage to this group right here. This song has been around ever since the beginning of time, for as I'm concerned. And I don't care how much time goes by. Every time you hear this song, if you don't think about your mother, I don't know what's wrong with you, but we have to honor our spinners tonight with Sadie.
It's not a Motown song, though. You know that, right?
No. Remember I told you.
In a world like today, it's a rare occasion to be able to see young mothers like the ones that were around when I grew up. But they live on in memory to quite a few of us. And this song is dedicated to those who cherish that memory. Early one Sunday morning, breakfast was on the table. There was no time to eat. She said to me,
brought her me to Sunday school, filled with the Lord of glory. We learned the whole story. She'll always have her dreams, despite the things this troubled world can bring. Oh, say, don't you know we love you, sweet Sadie? Place no one above you, sweet Sadie.
Well, well, well,
we live in the past.
Sometimes it seems so funny, no money will turn your life around. Sweeter than cotton candy, stronger than Papa's old brandy. Always that needed smile. Once in a while, she would break down and cry. Sometimes she'd be so happy, being with us and Daddy, standing the worst of times, breaking the binds with just a simple song. Oh, Sadie Mae, still loving us all in your special way. Well, well, well,
no one above you.
Felipe Wynn, I think, leading that song, Sadie.
Mm-hmm.
And I we hear that every Mother's Day. Okay, we are running down on time, but I don't care what the time is. We always stick with tradition. This is our time for our freestyle. So I hope y'all brought y'all best voices. And Brother Jamil, I asked you not to sing too much tonight because I wanted you to bring it down front and center first. So, come on, break
what
us out something.
What becomes of the brokenhearted who have love that's not departed? I know I got to find some kind of peace of mind. Tell me. Mm-hmm. There you go. It's a whole verse.
All right. And that sounded good, brother. Brother Kareem, you've been practicing. You cheated.
Well, you declared everything I was gonna say. I don't know what to do now.
You can say something. We
already. Okay. All right. Now I think I got something. Hopefully I can hit this. Sunshine, blue skies, please go away. My girl has found another. And gone away. With her went my future. My life is filled with gloom. So day after day, I'm still locked up in my room. I know to you, it might sound strange, but I wish it would rain. Oh, I wish it would rain, rain. Yeah, yeah. Okay. I'm good.
Oh, my goodness. Wow, okay. All right. That gave me goosebumps. Goosebumps, Brother Kareem. Brother, I know you got one. I know you got one for us. Come on.
Who is it? Me?
Brother Daniel.
Okay.
be a word to say how much I love you. One fulfilling word that shows how much I care. Wonderful could be the word. Yes, wonderful, I found the word. Oh, it's wonderful to be loved by you. It's wonderful to be needed by you. So much pride is what I felt inside. And for the hopeful guys, you reach for me.
Okay. That'll work. That will work. Okay, you know, I'm not gonna cheat y'all. I've been cheating and I've been coughing all night, but I'm gonna go ahead and do my freestyle since people have been telling me I don't do none and that ain't right. I'm gonna go ahead and do my freestyle and y'all can laugh at me if y'all want to, cause y'all know I've been coughing all night. Okay, but here we go. All right, y'all ready?
Ready.
Yes, man. Ready.
Okay. All right. Baby love, my baby love, I need you, oh how I need you. But now we have to go. Don't forget about you. Come back next week for more. Baby, 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 and I think you guys be up on all. You're the diamond in the sky. I'll forever cherish you. You know my love is true. Keep doing what you do. Baby, baby, baby. Okay, I've made a spectacle of myself. Now. Okay, listen, before we go, I know we've said this over the air many times, but of course, you know, Brother Reuben Muhammad made his transition on March the 12th, and today he was finally laid to rest. And I know a lot of you have been asking me about my profile picture. I don't mean to be insensitive. I kept the profile picture, I Love Reuben, up because I wanted to see my dear brother and honor him to the end. So today he was laid to rest. And may Allah be pleased with him.
That's
and
right.
So this is for Brother Reuben. We are not saying goodbye to his spirit nor his love, but we are going to say goodbye to the flesh. So here we are with one of Motown's greatest new groups, I think one of the final best groups that they ever put. And this is for you, Brother Reuben. We love you. May you rest in peace, and may Allah be pleased with you. Thank you, Brother Jamil. Thank you, Brother Daniel. Thank you, Brother Kareem, for your participation. Thank you, listening audience, all the people in the chat room, all of you on the line. Thank you so much. This is for Brother Reuben. One nation, one love.
How do I say goodbye to what we had? The good time that made us laugh, I'll wave back. I thought we gave. and I'll take with me some memories to be my sunshine as it rains. It's so hard to say goodbye to yesterday. And I'll take
y'all. Assalamu alaikum.
Wow.
Wow. Alaikum.
Salam.
Thank you.